Welcome to Radio Oldies, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today I'm in conversation with the actor Nigel Havers, very well known to most of our listeners, not just for his movies, but for his television work, The Charmer, of course, long stints in Coronation Street and Don't Wait Up, and the very popular long-running The Bidding Room. Now, I'm afraid we're in a slightly noisy restaurant, listeners, so bear with us. Now, I also have a personal reason for wanting to get you on Radio Oldie, Nigel, because in 1985, I was the producer's assistant on the British leg of an Australian movie called Burke and Wills. You starred in that movie, and we all went off for a very nice few days to film in a castle in Kent. So, Nigel Havers, 41 years later, we meet again, and I'm delighted to welcome you very warmly to Radio Oldie.
41 years. It's called Radio Oldie for a reason, then. Jesus. Anyway, yes, I'm still going. I do remember that shoot very well, because it was at the end of a grueling film. And then I was then making a film in Athens about Lord Elgin.
Oh, and interesting.
I'd already, signed up to do this film. And Graham Clifford, the director of Burke and Wills, rang and said, we want to shoot this thing in England. And I said, whoa, I'm not available. And he tore his hair out and said, well, I booked the dates and you've got to... So very kindly, I flew back from Athens the night before, filmed those 2 days and flew straight back to Athens to finish what I was filming. So I do remember it well, because it was kind of a traumatic moment, really.
But it was a very nice castle, I seem to remember, and very beautiful weather.
It was beautiful weather, a beautiful miniature castle.
Yes.
Do you remember? It was with a little moat round it.
A little moat round it,
and amazing. And I stayed the night there.
Yes, I think we all did.
We all did.
It was in some palatial suite.
Yes.
It really was.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
Yeah, it was great.
Now, can we start with your recent tour of your one-man show, Talking Bollocks? Tell our listeners all about it.
People for years have been saying, why don't you do a one-man show? And I said, don't be ridiculous, I'm far too young to do that.
Especially oldie.
And then one day someone said, actually, you're not. You're just about the right age. So I do it. And, I think you have to earn the right to do a one-man show.
Uh-huh.
In a way.
And what do you think that is?
Well, just being sticking at your job, yes. And collecting memories, collecting life experience. And then I feel that I'm not conning anybody. I've actually got something to say. And so that's what I felt. And so people said, are you going to write it? And I said, no, I just wing it. So there's no script. I just...
Do you? You just talk. So it's completely different every night.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah.
Have you ever run dry?
No, I've never run dry. I've run over. But I try not to, because I don't want to bore any audience. My wife comes with me, and she actually comes on stage a couple of times to bring me something or whatever. She doesn't speak, because if she spoke, I'd have to pay her, which obviously I'm not going to do that.
So you don't have an interview. It's just you standing on the stage.
Yes. I didn't want to be... I think just being interviewed is a bit of a con, really, because... I've done that before when I've been interviewed, and I get the interview up and I take the interview off stage and say, thank you for introducing me, you can now bugger off.
Quite right.
Yeah.
So what are you talking about? It can't all be complete bollocks, is it?
It probably is, actually. No, I mean, I kick off... I do a bit of magic, I do... Yeah, I do, and I talk about my career, I suppose. I've got lots of clips. I have a fantastic company manager and I have a huge screen. I've never seen a bigger screen in my life. And I do play clips, and there is some structure to it, otherwise... But I know, because my wife sits with him, and they go, oh, my God, where's he going now? But so I keep them on their toes.
When did you learn to do magic?
I do panto every year at the Palladium, and I have a dressing room that I share with a fantastic mate of mine called Paul Zerdin, who's a ventriloquist and a magician. And over the years, he's taught me a lot of magic.
Oh, interesting.
Mm. So I do a few tricks.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. And has it finished? Were you still going with it?
I did an Easter tour, and I'm now doing one in October.
Gosh.
And then I do two lots next year.
Gosh.
You know, there's lots of places to visit in the UK.
So, a lot of places. So, you've been all over already.
Yeah, well, I've been, out and about. I do one night only. I don't do a week. If I'm in a play, I have to do a whole week.
Yeah.
This is just, I hit and run.
Yeah. So can we go back to the beginning now?
Mm.
Was Chariots of Fire your... Is that when you people really...
No, it wasn't, actually. I'd done...
You'd been in Passage to India and things?
No.
Was that before?
That was after. I'd been on sitcom called Don't Wait Up.
Yes,
and that was a big popular thing.
And it went on for a long time.
Went on for a long time. So I... And, you know, when I did that, there were only 3 TV channels to watch.
Yes.
And there was ITV, BBC and BBC Two, but no one really watched BBC Two because they hadn't worked out what to put on BBC Two. And we filmed, you know, we did these things called Don't Wait Up, half-hour episodes that were filmed, and it was put out on a Monday night at 7:30. And on ITV, Granada had a sort of political show called The Week or something. And no one obviously wanted to watch that. So as they flicked through the 3 channels, the only one that was vaguely amusing was this new sitcom called Don't Wait Up. And on the first episode, we got 16 million views.
No, 16 million.
Yeah. And by the third episode, we had 20.
Good Lord.
Because that was all there was to watch. It wasn't because we were good, it was because there was nothing else to watch. And anyway, you were in 20 million people's sitting room on a Monday night. And that does make a difference. You walk down the street and everyone went, my God, that's that bloke on that. So Chariots of Fire was just a film. Nobody, you don't get that sort of viewers on a movie.
But it was a huge hit, isn't it?
It's huge hit because there was nothing else to watch.
But the film, the Chariots of Fire.
Oh, that was a film,
you won an award for it.
Mm. No, I didn't. I got nominated.
You got nominated?
Yeah.
Everybody remembers that. I don't know why it struck such a chord, that film. What do you think it was? It was Hugh Hudson's first film, wasn't it?
It was his first film, and it was about winning through all odds. The films about winning always work. It was also a very religious film.
Very.
Mm. And it was an anti-establishment film, which I enjoyed.
Yes.
And it had wonderful music.
Dick the Vangelis. Unbelievable music. And everybody remembers.
We had the title track, what we thought was the title track of the music, while we were running on the beach to do the opening sequence, playing to us on as we ran. And actually, that's not the music that ended up, because Vangelis wrote, when the film was cut and finished and put to bed, I was having dinner with David Putnam, the producer, and Vangelis burst into this restaurant and said, you must come, I've got the music, I've written another song for the film, another bit. And David said, well, it's too late, because he said, no, come. So we all piled into his van. He had this amazing van. And he played this music, and David said, my God.
Spine tingling.
We'll have to put this in the film. And so it's only at the beginning and the end, because we couldn't get it into the middle of the film, because it was all cut.
So let's talk about your beginnings then, because you're...
I went to boarding school when I was very young. I was sent to boarding school when I was 6, which was in those days considered to be quite normal.
Really. Yes.
And the school I went to was in Suffolk, and the people who ran the school were crazy about theatre, and we did a play every summer in the ground, which was a beautiful, beautiful sort of natural theatre, and we did a Shakespeare play every year. And I got cast very early on to be the page boy in Love's Labour's Lost. And once you're in the play, you will get in it every year. So I did a play and I realised by the time I was 8, I wanted to be an actor. And it was always quite handy to know what you want to do.
But it must have shocked your... given you come from such a prodigiously successful legal family, your father... being Michael Havis, your brother followed him into the law, your older brother, Philip.
My grandfather was a High Court judge.
Yes, who you played.
Well, I played my aunt as Dame Elizabeth Butler Sloss, a very eminent lawyer. They didn't mind.
They didn't mind?
No. I did run away.
from
No, I stayed there. But then I was supposed to follow my brother to a school I call Slough Grammar.
Oh, right, yes. I know what Slough Grammar is.
You know what Slough Grammar
is. I think our listeners will know what Slough Grammar
I was meant to go to Slough Grammar.
Yes.
And I refused.
Did you?
Yes, and my father was very forthright in his wishes and said, "Do not argue with me." And I was very, very, very determined not to go. And I found a drama school in London, and I went to him and said, "Look, this is what the drama school in London costs per term, and this is what Slough Grammar costs." And my father went, "You know, that drama school looks rather attractive." So I managed to get away with this. And I went to this drama school, which I researched.
What was the drama school?
It was called the Arts Educational Trust, and it had 138 girls and 42 boys, and I thought that ratio was about right when you're a teenager.
And he didn't mind your defection. I mean, that's quite a big defection. You went there
purely for financial reasons, I think.
From 13, you went.
14.
14.
Yeah.
Gosh.
And the rest is history. I had a very good time.
So are you close to your brother still?
I am very close to him.
Because what different... You went in such different directions.
Yeah, no. He... I mean, as a teenager, I would run across Park Lane to get to the other side. He would go on the underpass. That's pretty much sums it up. I mean, he doesn't want to dice with death, and I didn't care.
You did. And is it true? I think I read you or heard you say something. Is he also called Nigel? What is this?
His middle name is... My parents were drunk when we were christened, and it came to me, and one of their best friends was an actor called Nigel Patrick.
Oh, yeah.
So I was named after him. And then my second name is Alan, named after my father's other best friend, Alan Goatley. So I was Nigel Alan Havers, and my brother was Philip. And then they thought, hang on, what was his middle name? Oh, we'll call it Nigel.
That's so funny.
So he got Nigel. And, you know, I hate my Christian name, actually. I think Nigel is the most awful name.
But it's got bad associations just at this moment in politics, does it not?
It's terrible. I hated it well before he got on the scene. No one's been christened Nigel for many, many years. In fact,
wasn't very, very gathering in a pub.
I think yes,
Nigel.
But I don't think they've been christened Nigel for the last 20 years. So there you go. But you know the most popular boy's name has been for the last 5 years.
Muhammad.
That says quite something, doesn't it?
It's really interesting, yeah. I saw that. And the girl's name is Olivia. That's interesting.
I think it's rather nice, Olivia.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, and where does that come from? But Muhammad, doesn't that say everything about our demographics?
Say no more.
Say no more.
We'll be sent to prison if we said any more.
Right, yes, leave that.
Yeah.
So can we talk about the Charmer a little bit? Because
Yes, the Charmer was a job I got sent, and I remember thinking at sort of midnight, I was just about to go to bed, and I thought I'd better read episode one, and by sort of 4 a.m, I finished it. You couldn't put it down, and it was based on a novel by...
Patrick Hamilton, Horse Trilogy, which I'm obsessed with Patrick Hamilton.
Me
I think
too.
He's a genius.
He's absolutely genius.
Yeah.
Very dark.
Very dark, but he's...
Alcoholic writers, you may or may not know.
Yeah, Hanover Square.
Incredible.
He's just brilliant writer.
I'm obsessed with his book. Mm. So there's no way I'm going to say no to that. And the character was so wicked that I love playing it, because, you know, they're much more interesting to play than goody-goodies. But I finished filming it, and they cut it together, and they showed me episode one, and I thought, my God... I probably never work again, because he was so awful, this man. And yet, when it went out, it was so popular, they wanted me to make the next series. And I said, but I'm dead. I've been hanged at the end. They said, no, there's always a way. In fact, there's an earlier book about love. There were two novels we wrote about.
Ah.
And there's an earlier one that people don't know about. But no, that wasn't as interesting as the second one, so there was no point in going back.
Yeah.
So they said, no, we'll reinvent. And I said, no, let's leave it on a high. So I didn't do anymore. Yeah. But it was a great character to play.
But do you think it's interesting, the charm, because it's really stuck to you like glue, this reputation of being charming.
Well, just the title, just the title.
No, but I know, but I think you do, I think everyone, you know, if I say your name to them, oh yes, the charming one.
I know.
But you are charming. I mean,
But years later, you know, funny enough, years later, ITV, with Corrie, were thinking about a character, and they came up, and what I play in Corrie, Coronation Street, was exactly the same. That's based on that character. Charming, you know, people have money, and so in a phrase, I've done that character twice.
But you did it for over 100 episodes in Coronation Street, didn't you?
Was it really that many? I suppose it was.
I think.
I came in and out of it. You know, they were very sweet because I didn't want to be there for a month. So I used to do, you know, I used to guest on it, which not many actors have been able to do, but I managed to get away with that. To go in a few months out.
And not have to sign a great big contract.
Exactly, I never signed a great big contract. It was a lovely job to do.
Oh, no, it's getting very, very noisy in here. We might have to wait a minute. Can we talk a bit about that famous moment on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here? You got very cross.
That was a big error. Doing that. I made the error, I made a terrible error of not watching the programme before I did it.
You went into that not knowing what went. Oh my goodness, no wonder that was an error. Yeah.
It was an error. The trouble was when I was in there, I wanted to kill somebody. I can't tell you his name, Lembik Ope. And I wanted to kill him. And the trouble with wanting to kill somebody is in the jungle is that there were a lot of cameras on you. So every night in my hammock, I slept on the floor. During the night, I devised ways of killing him.
Why was he so awful? What did he do?
He was an MP. He was absolutely ghastly. In every way possible.
What, egomaniac?
I can't remember, really, but I remember thinking, what a ghastly thing. And I wanted to kill him.
And you didn't know they were going to be...
I wanted to either strangle him. Or there was one knife we had to cook with, and I wanted to get the knife and stab him to death. And then I thought, God, if I do that... And there's no way out. I couldn't tell the judge. It wasn't me, sir, because there'll be footage of it.
So from many angles.
So I thought, I'd better get out of here. So I'd commit. I don't care about spiders or creepy crawlies. I'm not remotely worried about it. I was just worried about killing somebody. So I had to get out of there. Also, the boredom. You can't read a book. You can't read anything.
You can't read a book?
No, you can't take anything to read or write. You have to sit there all day.
What?
Yeah. So I sat there wanting to kill Lembik Ope. Mind you, he's a politician, and I do like to kill. I would like to kill quite a lot of politicians.
Well, that's a whole different story. So
I'm gearing up to kill the new Prime Minister.
Well.
Which I know nothing about.
Well, that
mind is... you. I mean, I find it extraordinary that you can become Prime Minister without any qualifications.
I think it's really shocking. I agree.
I mean, why didn't they choose me? Or you?
I would put yourself up.
I mean, as much right to be right as he has.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I think most elders, I can probably speak for a lot of them, you know, like the idea of due process, of which
I think
there was none.
You've got to have some
due
process. Oh, well, he used to be in the... Yeah, but that's 20 years ago. And he didn't succeed in anything when he was in the cabinet.
No, but it is a worry. Mm. I quite agree. So, what's next? You're doing Panto.
I'm doing my one-man show in October, and then I do Panto, and then I do a thing called The Bidding Room.
Oh, yes, I want to talk to you about that. That's become hugely popular. And why I'm asking you about your charm is that only yesterday somebody said, oh, have you seen The Bidding Room? That charming Nigel Hayes, I thought, that's so funny.
it's
really stuck to you like glue, this charm.
I know, I can't help that. I'm not going to argue with it.
No.
No, it's great. I love doing The Bidding Room. I love the people there are nothing but good things to say about that.
You learnt a lot about the stuff.
Yes.
Have you?
My wife says I'm impossible if I go into an antique shop because she says you pretend to know all about and you say things like, that's a fake. That's not worth anything. She says she disowns me when I'm in an antique shop. I think I know everything about antiques now.
Well, how long has it been running? It's been running a long time now.
I think it's 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how regularly do you do that?
I do it once or twice a year, once a year, something like that.
In chunks?
In chunks. We do, like, many, many episodes in one hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah. and then that you're left free to do. Who's in Panto this year with you?
The usual gang.
Julian Clary.
Julian Clary, Paul Zerdin and me. And then with this year we've got French and Saunders playing the Ugly Sisters.
Oh, fuck.
I mean, they've both been in the Panto individually, but not together.
They must have sold out already, isn't it?
I think probably.
Is that really fun to do? And you have to do it right the way. You don't have to do one on Christmas Day, do you?
Actually, we don't on Christmas Day. But that's the only day we don't. We do two a day every day. It's quite stressful in that respect. But it does get you out of doing Christmas.
Well, I was going to ask you, what is your Christmas like?
Well, it's mostly spent at the Palladium. But it's,
And where is your wife, Georgina, through all this?
She's with me. We're at the Palladium, mostly. Oh, we come here for Christmas Day.
What, this restaurant?
Yeah.
We're in the park, listeners.
Yeah.
Very, very lovely restaurant.
Yeah.
Oh, just
they do a Christmas lunch.
Wonderful.
It's fantastic. And we walk across the park with our dog. We have a very rare breed of dog.
What is it?
It's very rare. It's a poodle. Poodle.
A real poodle?
Yeah. Poodle. Poodle. Not a something poodle or a that.
No.
It's a real poodle. Not many of those around.
No, and they're very, very clever. My grandmother had poodles.
Yeah.
So, Georgina, your first wife died, didn't she?
She did, yeah.
William's sister.
Yeah. Long time ago now.
So how long you've been married now? For
20-odd years. God, how time flies when you're having fun.
Yes. I did see that. Cause the odd thing is, as we all know, getting older means time goes very fast.
Yes.
And it seems really recently that your first wife died. I was so shocked when I read it, actually. Well, over actually, 20 years ago.
You can slow time down.
How?
Well, just
please tell us.
By enjoying every moment.
That makes it go faster in my experience.
By thinking every moment. And not sleeping at all. Actually, I do sleep. So, but I mean, that would be good not to. If you didn't have to sleep, you could do so
you
much.
You could do more. You could do more. Yes. So what's happening next year?
I hate to think. I don't want to know, really. I think I've got all sorts of things that I'm meant to be doing, but I'll try and get out of them. I spend my whole life trying to get out of things, really. I want to stay at home and enjoy life.
You obviously do.
I know, I haven't retired. My brother has retired. He's a barrister, and he actually retired. He said, are you going to retire? I said, no. Actors never retire. They get retired, by the way, when people stop phoning them up and asking them to do work.
Sister.
Yeah, they don't retire, they just get retired when people stop offering them jobs. When they realise that
you keep getting offered things.
So I keep going on.
You'll never retire in that.
No, because actors don't, because we just don't do that. Right. I mean, Michael Caine, who's a great mate of mine, he did say, I'm retiring now, but he said he was 90 at the time, and he decided that was it.
So can we just talk very quickly before I let you go about what was it like working on the Guy Ritchie thing? That must have been fun.
It was fun. It's quite quick, but I really enjoyed it. And to play something a bit different, I think I went a bit mad, really. But I love the show too. I mean, The Gentleman was great, wasn't it?
It's really.
Yeah. But Guy Ritchie, he's quite some director, isn't he? I mean, he does. You know, he's got a particular style, and you know, a Guy Ritchie film, you can spot it a mile away.
So you've got no films lined up for next
year. Not at the moment, no. I hope not. There's something that's brewing and I'm a bit, ooh, God, this might work.
Ah, telly or film?
A film. But you know films are God. How anyone ever makes a film? There's so many barriers to stop you doing it.
But there's so many people involved. I mean, a ridiculous amount of people.
Yeah, and there's too much people, you know, put money and then they take it out. And then they put it back in again. I don't know how films get made. I mean, when we did Chariots of Fire, we were training for, you know, four or five months before to be these athletes. And towards the end, a man came out of nowhere to our training camp and said, oh, by the way, the film's off. The money.
No.
Yeah. So we all went, what? So we all went to the pub that night, having not had a drink for months, and had a drink. And the next morning, David went around and said, the film's back on.
Well, he is a genius.
Oh, complete genius. I still see him.
He's still going, isn't he?
Yeah. In fact, there was one stage when David said, why don't you ring your dad and ask him to invest in the film? And I remember ringing my father, and David Putnam was sort of listening to the phone call, and I said to Dad, you know, hello, Dad. And Dad said, no. Oh, darling boy, how's the film going? I said, it's going very well. Would you like to, reinvest the money? And he said, don't be fucking ridiculous. And David Putnam could hear that. And had he invested some money, he would have made a fortune. So there you go.
Oh, does he know that? Did you tell him afterwards?
I did.
Can we talk quickly about your latest project, The Golden Boys? Because that sounds extremely exciting.
It's a true story of a financial crime that took place in Sweden, and I play the character of Lord Moyne, Jonathan Guinness, who was involved in this swindle. He managed to get out of it before he got caught, so to speak. I have to be quite careful because he's still alive. But, it's a fantastic show, and I don't know, Swedish television is of very high quality, and I was asked to be in it. I went over and spent some time in Sweden with the most amazing crew and fantastic actors. And it's called Golden Boys, and it's on, well, you just have to Google it. It's on Prime TV. There you go.
Oh, Prime. Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
And it's really.
And what did the swindle involve?
Great big financial con.
How brilliant.
These guys, these Swedish boys, they were in Saint-Tropez, it must have. And they went to Biblos Hotel, which is a famous hotel in Saint-Tropez, and they racked up a bill of 137,000 euros one night.
When was this?
In the 80s.
I mean, that's like a million now or something, mad.
137,000 euros in one evening is quite a bill. I've seen the bill. It's an incredible... Yeah, they were... extravagant is the word that comes to mind.
Oh, what fun.
Yeah, what fun. It was a great thing to film, sir, and I loved it. As I said, the actors and the crew were great. It was wonderful.
Apart from I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, have you ever really not liked doing something?
No. That's the only thing I had to get out of. I'm a Celebrity, I have to get out of here.
And you did, you left early, did you?
I did, I left as soon as I could, before I killed Lembik Opec.
Who do you think is the greatest movie director you've worked with? Or
David Lean, probably.
Oh.
But because he sort of was a legend and a giant, and I don't mean to exclude any other director, but he was, you know, one of the great directors of all time. So, you know, I learned a hell of a lot from him. I was in this film he made called Passage to India,
yeah.
And I said to him very early on, if on the days I'm not actually in front of the camera, could I sit next to you behind the camera? And he said, absolutely. So I spent a lot of time sitting with him, and that's really kind of how I learnt my craft.
Have you never thought of directing yourself?
I love to direct, and I have directed a TV drama.
And what was that called?
It was called... I can't remember the name of it now. But, you know, if you're directing... It's, you know, one film will take most of your year.
Yes.
And
yes.
I really haven't got the patience for that.
No. And life's short.
Life's too short, yeah.
Oh, well, Nigel, it's been an absolute treat to talk to you. Thank you so
absolute
very
pleasure.
Much.
And I'm
Thank
sorry you. About the noise, but it gives it atmos.
Well, that's true. You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Nigel Havers. If you enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more like this, please go to theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, many, many thanks to you again, Nigel, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Bailey Gifford, actual investors who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.